This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio with a special broadcast recorded this past Friday in Charlotte at the National Innocence Network Conference. Ever get punished for something you didn't do? Remember the frustration of trying to convince a parent or teacher it wasn't you, and no matter what you said and no matter how much evidence you could marshal, you were stuck and you, not the real culprit, would pay the price. Now imagine spending 10 or 20 years in prison under the same circumstances, or maybe sitting on death row. We know it happens because in just the past 20 years, more than 300 people serving in prison have been exonerated using DNA evidence. And if you include non-DNA evidence, the number triples. At least 100 of those people were in Charlotte this past weekend for the Innocence Network Conference. Today we're going to bring you some of their stories. Joining us now to talk about the conference is Keith Findlay. He's an assistant professor of law at the University of Wisconsin Law School and the president of the Innocence Network, which held the conference this past weekend. Welcome, Keith. Good to have you here.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
What's the purpose? Tell us about this conference that you had over the weekend. What's the purpose of the conference?
Yeah, sure. The conference is the annual get-together of the Innocence Network, which is the affiliation of some 63 innocence organizations from around the country, indeed around the world. And it's the opportunity we have to come together once a year to learn from one another, to work on our policy agenda, and to share the experience that so many of these exonerees have gone through. So it's a wonderful opportunity to see them and to recognize them for their strength and courage and the grace that they've shown in enduring this horrible injustice.
We hear Innocence Network, and I know a lot of us are familiar with the Innocence Project. Are they related? Are they connected?
Yes, the Innocence Project is one of the Innocence organizations that comprise the Innocence Network. It is certainly the largest. It was the first organized. In a sense, you might think of it as the flagship organization, but all of the other organizations are actually independent of one another, but they then have come together to form this network.
So we think of the Innocence Project as working on getting people out of prison who shouldn't be there and getting exonerations once that all happens. The network is broader and I think takes a look at what happens sort of before, during, and after. Tell us about the scope then of the network. What do you do?
Sure. Yeah. The network and its member organizations are first and foremost concerned about identifying wrongly convicted people in prison and getting them out, trying to correct the injustice as soon as we can. But certainly we recognize that doesn't solve the problem entirely, that there are many other wrongly convicted people in prison, and that the system continues to make mistakes that put people in prison. So a large part of the mission of the network member organizations and the network itself is to understand the causes of wrongful convictions and then at a policy level work to reform the criminal justice system so that we can try to prevent miscarriages of justice like this from happening in the future, perhaps in cases where there is no DNA evidence that can come along and correct the mistake later. And the third component of it that you mentioned there, which is very much true, is that while we're sort of struggling to figure out how to do this, one of the serious problems that we do have to confront is that when people are exonerated and released from prison, very often there is very little aftercare provided by the system for those individuals. Ironically, in most states, if you're actually guilty of the crime, you get more support from the state once you're paroled than you do if you're innocent and set free. And yet the experience of being wrongly convicted, it can be a life-shattering experience, one that has ramifications that can last the rest of the lifetime. So we try to confront those problems and figure out how best to ameliorate them.
Give us a sense of the scope. I think I did a little bit in the intro. I think at last count, 306 people exonerated because of DNA evidence. And again, I think we're going back to 1989 here.
That's right.
So, and then over 1,000 if you use other kinds of evidence
that we know of.
And that's the other part of it. There is no factor. There is no way to calculate how many, even based on that number, how many people are wrongfully convicted and still behind bars.
There's that. We don't know. That's exactly right. We have no way of knowing or counting the number of wrongful convictions in which people still remain in prison. But we actually don't have a very good means of counting either the number of innocent people who've been exonerated, because up until recently there was no attempt to keep track of that, to count those people. And so only within the last year or so have we created this this registry of exonerees. That was created by our friends at the University of Michigan Law School and at Northwestern School of Law. And their methods are as good as they could come up with. But because no jurisdiction counts these cases, they had to go back to searching the internet, looking for media accounts. And so as thorough as this search has been, we know that even that count is pretty grossly under-inclusive.
And when we talk about exoneration, that's not the same as releasing people who are shown not to have committed the crime. Exoneration is a separate step in most states, is it not?
Well, in many jurisdictions, exoneration is actually not a legal term. Researchers and the Innocence Network use that term typically to refer to individuals whose convictions have been overturned because of evidence of new innocence, and then they were not convicted again, acquitted at a retrial, or the prosecutor dismissed the charges, or they're in a few jurisdictions they find they have a finding of actual innocence, but most jurisdictions do not.
Well, those are some pretty important distinctions, because if for instance, a judge awards somebody a new trial, that doesn't necessarily mean that the charges have been taken away, so their future is very much in doubt.
That's right.
Because they have not been acquitted, so they can be retried.
That's right.
That's one condition. Another condition is to have those charges dismissed. And then finally, what we would call exoneration, which is to say not only have they been dismissed, but we realize we have the wrong person and somebody else may have come forward. And all of that changes the future for those individuals, depending on which state and which condition, I guess, they're in, legal conditions.
That's exactly right. Yeah, getting the conviction overturned for many individuals is not the end of the road. It's just the beginning of the next chapter, because many of them are confronted with charges that they're basically put back to square one. And in some instances, prosecutors will retry them. In many, they don't. But it's remarkably hard for the criminal justice system to acknowledge its mistakes.
So tell us about this conference. How many of these, in a sense, reunions or unions have you had where you've brought people together like this? How many times have you done it?
I believe the first time we did it was in about 2000. So this would be our 13th conference. And in fact, we've been doing the conferences for longer than there has been a network. The network itself was, in a sense, an outgrowth of the conferences, because the first Innocence Project, the project in New York, was created in 1992. Other projects began forming after that, and by 1999, we were maybe a half dozen or so. And the projects then started coming together saying, we've got a lot to share and learn from one another. And so we started meeting as creating these conferences. And from there, we realized that we had something bigger than that happening. This was really the beginning of an innocence movement, and we needed a center for that. And so we started forming the Innocence Network after that.
We're going to talk to a couple of people and hear their stories, people who have been exonerated. But I wonder, just in the broad strokes, how much you've learned, what kinds of things you learned just by bringing people together who've had similar but certainly unique experiences?
Well, what we learn, I think, is reflected in the way the conference is structured. We learn all kinds of things. We learn about the causes of wrongful convictions. We learn about strategies for litigating them and investigating them to obtain relief for individuals. But one of our tracks also is an exoneree track, where the exonerees come together and they share with one another. They connect. They provide emotional support. They learn about managing finances on the outside again. They learn about how to tell their stories in books, how to obtain compensation. And then we learn a lot about what policy reform efforts have worked in other jurisdictions around the country. And so we come up with ideas and strategies for trying to make the system work better in the future.
At this point, are there some states that are better than others? And what has worked? What kinds of reforms have you seen?
Yeah, there certainly are some states that are more aggressive on the policy reform front than others. That's absolutely true. To date, I think it's fair to say that most of the reform efforts have occurred in a few specific areas. One has been in laws requiring preservation of and access to biological evidence for post-conviction DNA testing. And now we have nearly every state in the country, at least 49, if not the 50th so far, that require to some degree or another access to evidence for DNA testing. Less uniform around the country are some other important reforms in the areas such as eyewitness identification procedures. We now know from looking at these cases that by far eyewitness identification error is the leading contributor to wrongful convictions. On this front, North Carolina is probably one of the leaders in terms of understanding the problem and coming up with reforms to improve the way that police collect identification evidence.
And how do you do that? What is the reform when it comes to eyewitness evidence?
Well, there's a fairly long list of reforms. Some of the basic, the most important elements to that include using a procedure that it's called a double-blind procedure, which means that neither the witness nor the police officer conducting the procedure should know who the suspect is before conducting the procedure, because otherwise, even inadvertently, that knowledge can taint the process. It also includes things like making sure that the proper selection of fillers, there's guidelines. Those are the known innocents who round out the lineup. There's a very important reform that's been adopted widely here, which calls for sequential presentation of suspects and fillers rather than the traditional, you know, six-pack where you show them six photos all at once. You show them one at a time, and that really encourages the witness to engage in an absolute judgment process rather than a relative judgment process, which the research has shown can lead to errors.
Yeah, we see that. If you put more than one, we'll always pick two and make a comparison between one and the other, even though we don't feel like we're doing that.
Yeah, well, it's a natural way that the human mind works, is we'd like to make comparative judgments. So we'll look and find, you know, who among the people in the lineup looks most like our memory of the perpetrator. And as naturally, there's always going to be one person in the lineup who looks most like the perpetrator compared to the others. That's the one we'll pick. But if the real perpetrator's not in there, we've just picked an innocent person.
On the State of Things today, we are recording in Charlotte, talking about the Innocence Network Conference, talking with Keith Findley, Assistant Professor of Law at the University of Wisconsin Law School, and the President of the Innocence Network, holding the conference. Just ahead, we will meet two exonerees and hear their stories on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay tuned. This is the State of Things from Spirit Square in Charlotte. I'm Frank Stasio. Today in Charlotte for the National Innocence Network Conference. It was held this weekend. We were there. We recorded this program. Keith Findley is with us, Assistant Professor of Law at the University of Wisconsin, the President of the Innocence Network, and he also represented one of our next guests, Audrey Edmonds. Audrey is an exoneree from Minnesota. She was sentenced to 18 years in prison for the death of a 7-month-old baby. Authorities incorrectly surmised that the child died of shaken baby syndrome. Audrey Edmonds, welcome to the State of Things. Good to have you here on the show.
Thank you.
Also with us is Benny Starks. Benny was wrongfully convicted of the rape and beating of a 69-year-old woman in Illinois. He spent 20 years in prison before DNA evidence proved him innocent. Benny Starks, welcome to the State of Things. Good to have you.
Thanks for having me.
And also Benny's attorney is with us. Vanessa Potkin is here as well. Vanessa, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
So, Audrey, let me start with you and ask you a little bit about your story. Tell us what happened and how it was that you came to be arrested for that.
I was brought to my care. I wasn't a licensed daycare provider, but I was brought to my care on a Monday morning, a baby that was just days short of 7 months old, and she was very, very fussy, and this was not normal for her. What was unnormal was she had not taken her bottle at home that morning before she came to my house. The mom brought her. She said she'd been up with her twice during the night. She'd been very fussy. She had gone to the doctor the latter part of the week before, that she was being treated for an ear infection. I was a mom. I took care of other children, and I thought, well, I'll try to feed her bottle. She continued to fuss, and I tried to feed her bottle, and she wasn't taking her bottle. So finally, I put her in a room away from the other children and myself so we could go on with our morning before we all got ready and went to preschool. And so I put this baby into a room in her car seat with a propped up bottle, thinking hopefully that would pacify her and she would take some bottle and go to sleep. When I went in just about an hour later to get her, she stopped crying and her head tilted a little bit. And I thought, well, this poor baby is finally going to sleep. As a mom, I knew that babies cry and cry and cry and they get tired, and a 7-month-old doesn't look at you and say, I'm going to sleep now. So I didn't think anything wrong until I started to put her jacket on and some formula came out of her nose. And then I I knew something was wrong, and so I picked her up and I started patting her on her back, and she wasn't responding. And it took me a few seconds before I realized there was something serious going on with this. So I went outside my home very quickly, holding the baby upright in my arms, and I was yelling and screaming at a neighbor lady to come help me. And then I went inside. I called 911. I started to do CPR, and then the medical staff arrived at the house. Later that afternoon, I went to the hospital to visit the family, and the baby was having tests done, and they said they'd keep me posted as far as what was going on. And at that time, I knew of nothing. I just kept thinking, they're going to revive this child and everything will be fine. She was choking, and I had no clue what was going to happen in the next 7 months to my life. And then in March, I was charged with first-degree reckless homicide. I pled not guilty, and in November of 96, I had a trial, and I was found guilty of first-degree reckless homicide for shaken baby syndrome. This child had a subdural hematoma in her head, and she had some retinal damage, and those were triad symptoms of what then was identified as shaken baby syndrome. I was very fortunate I wasn't taken right into custody. I was sentenced in February that following year to 18 years in prison, 12 years maximum. And I was marched off to the women's maximum security prison.
When did you first realize that you might be charged, that there might be a criminal investigation?
Earlier that year, about in January, I was still pregnant. I was pregnant with my third daughter. I was told by an attorney that he had been contacted by the DA and they were going to charge me with this. And I was just, I was devastated. I could not at all figure out why.
As Keith, in this case, you were Audrey's attorney in this case. We're looking at a postmortem diagnosis that comes up with this, and it's that diagnosis that becomes the basis of the charge, right? I mean, explain how that works for us.
Yeah, this is one of those kind of unusual types of cases that we sometimes call them as a science-dependent prosecution, because the entirety of the case against her was based on the medical opinions, based on these findings of conditions within the brain. And at the time of her trial, the mainstream medical opinion was that when you see these things inside the brain, there's one and only one thing that can cause that, and that's shaken baby syndrome. In the 10 years following her trial, fortunately for Audrey, considerable amount of medical research was done that undermined the basis for that hypothesis and demonstrated that, in fact, there are many things that can cause those subdural hematomas and retinal hemorrhages and things like that that she referred to, including things like choking on formula or infection, a whole range of things. So at that point, we were able to present that to the court, and she was actually convicted in Wisconsin. Then the Wisconsin Court of Appeals reversed her conviction, saying this is important. The mainstream medical community has changed its mind about an awful lot that's going on here, and a new jury needs to see this. They reversed the conviction, and the state then dismissed all the charges.
It's interesting because you said at that point, but in a sense, if you talk about the kind of slow progress of medical evidence, it's not a point, is it? I mean, this stuff comes out. So how do you know? I mean, are you paying attention to this kind of thing regularly? When do you decide there's a critical mass and we need to bring this back to the court?
Well, it's really a case-by-case assessment. You look at the cases and you figure out, where did this happen in relation to the development of the scientific research? What was the nature of the testimony presented at the trial in this case? Was it out of step with what was happening then? Was it out of step with what we learned later? And so because in each of these shaken baby cases, even the particular point at issue may be different from another. Audrey's case happened to involve virtually all of the basic contentions at issue in a shaken baby case. We had new science undermining the hypothesis that shaking alone can even cause these kinds of injuries. We had new evidence showing that the amount of force needed was not as massive as that they testified to at her trial, so that it could have been accidental. And we had new evidence showing that, in fact, there can be what's known as a lucid interval, that is a period of time in which after the child suffers an injury, in which the child remains conscious and aware and responsive, so you no longer can time the injury and therefore can't say, well, because the child was in Audrey's care at that moment, she has to be the one who committed the crime. And so other cases will have only one or two or three of those components, or maybe something different. So, and each of those has a different research base.
And in this case, there were not only other things that could have caused what we did see, but the science had determined, medical science had determined that we should see other things if it were shaken baby syndrome, that in this case we didn't.
Well, that's right. One of the things that particularly the biomechanical research that's occurred in recent years has shown us is that to shake a child hard enough to cause death or serious brain injury is almost humanly impossible, probably is humanly impossible. But if you were to do it, you would certainly see massive neck injury. You would see bruising on the ribs and arms where the child was gripped. None of that was present in Audrey's case. This child had no such external injuries and no neck injuries whatsoever. The neck is going to fail long before the brain injuries will occur.
Audrey, what was this experience like for you? You're going to prison for a crime you didn't commit. Did you think you were going to get out when you first went in?
Yeah, I did. I had always hoped so. I never ever expected it to take so long. This is why it's good we can't see what's going to happen in our life all the time. I probably would have jumped off a bridge had I known I was going to be there that long. But then I've got a Benny over here who did a lot more time, and it's very, very hard time. I had three young children. I was incarcerated 2 days after my youngest daughter's first birthday, and that's really, really hard.
What did you do? How did you keep yourself together in this situation?
I was very fortunate to still have my family close with me. I had a lot of support. I was very, very fortunate to have that support grow and grow. And the best thing that I could do was to keep my mind as much as I could outside the prison fences. And I was very, very fortunate also to have continuous legal assistance in the appeals process and then on to the Innocence Project taking on my case, where many people don't have any legal representation for many years and they're sitting innocent in their cells.
Frank, can I just add one thing about this? I think is really reflective of the strength of character that helped Audrey get through this. The whole process was marred by incredible delays. It takes much longer than anybody can imagine to resolve a case like this. And we used to call her up and talk to her about the next delay in the case. And it was sort of ironic. She would wind up sort of propping us up emotionally, telling us it was okay. And one of the things we learned that she did was that while she was in prison every day serving 18 years for a crime she didn't commit, she kept a gratitude book where every day she'd go back to her cell and write down all the things she had to be grateful for. And I just found that to be just incredibly – just remarkable.
Well, it was indeed. And you served how many years? It was –
11.
11 years.
Mm-hmm.
You were very close, actually, to the time when you might have gotten out.
Correct. At 12 years was my maximum release time. I'd seen parole, and it was like you've never done enough time for your crime, and then they always smacked it in my face that I wouldn't admit to it.
Even after you were released, isn't that right?
Correct.
That the parents still wanted an apology from you after the courts found that you were not guilty.
Right.
Well, Benny Starks, you served more time. You were in prison for 20 years, serving a 60-year sentence. Tell us about your case.
It was just a typical day, a Saturday. Just wake up normal like I did today. And went out and did some errands, paid some bills, cashed my check. Well, just powered in, went a couple of bars. Up until maybe like around 10:30 that night, and as I was leaving the bar, I was approached by two gentlemen who actually robbed me of money, my watch, and other personal things, my coat. After tussling with them and stuff, I managed to get away, ran to my mom's house, and like 4 days later, police came to my mother's house and said that they wanted to question me about a battery charge. I went to the police station. 69-year-old woman was beaten. They questioned me about it, where my whereabouts were, and this and that. And then they said, hey, we found your coat. At the scene of this alleged crime. They identified the coat from a cleaner's tag and traced it back to me. I'm like, yeah, well, that's my coat. Well, this is what happened. And, I guess that's if you found it and you're saying that it's a crime committed, I guess that's how I got there, the guys that actually robbed me. So they questioned me, and then for hours, next thing I know, I was charged with aggravated battery and two counts of criminal sexual assault. Went to trial, was sentenced to 60 years in prison.
When you were first picked up, when they first called you in for questioning, and then you began to realize, you know, what the charge was going to be, what were you thinking at the time? What were you thinking at the time?
I wasn't thinking that I was going to be incarcerated for 20 years, 9 months, and 5 days. I mean, I didn't, you know, that was the furthest thing from my mind.
Now, at this point, they've got there is some evidence at the scene. There's a jacket that you acknowledge is yours, and that they can trace it to you. Any other material evidence as the trial went on that linked you to the crime?
But you know what? Now, you just come. I'm going to get back to what you just said. Now, it was my coat, but as far as a photo picture, we have never saw that. It was a sketch picture of my coat. So, I mean, I was in the vicinity. Now, this lady said that she was attacked between 8:30 and 9 o'clock. I have state witnesses that testified for the state say that I was in the bar until almost 11 o'clock after the fact. So right now today, I still have not seen any photo pictures of where this crime scene was even at.
And one of the issues that Benny is bringing up is this coat, you know, that belonged to him. There was never documentation of where it was found at the crime scene. Was it right where the attack happened? Was it 100 yards away? Because both Benny and the victim lived very close to where the crime scene was.
And how were you? There was an identification, right? The victim identified you. Tell us how that happened.
She can probably answer that.
Yeah. Well, what's a little bit difficult is that, you know, once the Innocence Project started looking into Benny's case, we've never been able to see the photographs that were shown to the victim. We know that she was hospitalized. Something did happen to her. She was badly beaten. And some type of photo procedure was done while she was in the hospital. We don't know the quality of it. But we, knowing now that Benny's completely innocent, it's kind of the conclusion is inescapable that there had to be some type of suggestion going on in that lineup for her to happen to pick an innocent man who the police had already zeroed in on.
What was the law at the time? This is in Illinois, right? Why didn't you have access to that? What was the procedure? How was it done? Where's the photograph? I guess that was legal. That was acceptable court procedure?
Well, I'm saying now when the Innocence Project took on Benny's case to work for his exoneration, we could never find the photo array. So we can't go back and, you know, see what was actually done.
What did it take to well, let me ask you, and I'll stick with you, Vanessa, how then was Benny exonerated?
Well, Benny first wrote into the Innocence Project in 1997 or 8. We took on his case. And we got DNA testing in 2000 that excluded him from biological evidence on the victim's clothing. And in many jurisdictions around this country, that would have been enough for everyone to recognize he was an innocent man. Quite disgracefully, his exoneration didn't come for 13 years later. He was just cleared in January of this year of all charges related to this crime. And that had to do with a very difficult prosecutor's office in Lake County, Illinois, that refused to recognize DNA and science and just clung to convictions at all costs. Thankfully, there's been a change in the administration there, and it seems to be a new day. But for Benny, it was 13 years of fighting in the face of DNA that proved his innocence, which is pretty remarkable and unusual.
Take us back to that moment, Benny, when you find out, here it is, the DNA evidence shows I wasn't there. What were you thinking then?
It was like, you know, thank God. I was still in prison, but I was like, hey, I'm going to go home. I know I'm going to go home. It was just difficult, as my attorney Vanessa said, to deal with these prosecutors. A lot of it was race and politics, and it was like, hey, we don't believe in DNA. This is, you know, garbage.
Now, you are African-American. Was your victim white or black?
She was a Latina lady. So that could have played a part in the identification procedure. We know that cross-racial identifications are far less reliable. But another big important aspect of Benny's case involves bite mark comparison evidence, because that played a big role. The police, in investigating this case, noticed a contusion on the victim's shoulder area and consulted with a local dentist who had practically no training in bite mark comparison. And they went and got mold from Benny and said, aha, it's a match, and there are dozens of unique characteristics. And what we've learned since that time and is that bite mark comparison evidence is extraordinarily unreliable. You might even call it junk science. The National Academy of Sciences has issued a report saying, you know, cautioning against using this evidence in any courtroom, let alone the way it was used against Benny to say this had to be the person who did this.
So you talked about the prosecutor rejecting science. We're seeing more and more of that now, that facts and science will not play a part in public policy or in the criminal justice system. But why is it up to the prosecutor? Isn't there – aren't there judges here who can be shown this and say to the judge, this man is innocent, let him free?
Unfortunately, you know, with regard to the DNA evidence, you know, sometimes – you know, the justice system just doesn't work as it should, and judges just go along with what the prosecutors are arguing. That's what we experienced in Lake County, you know, during those years. In addition, you know, unfortunately, the courts aren't doing their job as well as they should have in terms of being the gatekeepers of what comes into the courtrooms under the cloak of science. There has to be greater scrutiny. There's absolutely, you know, no demonstrated validity to this bite mark evidence. And yet, you know, pretty much any Joe Schmo dentist who, you know, says somebody else trained me can go in and help send a man away for 60 years.
On the State of Things today, we're talking about the Innocence Network Conference in Charlotte. With us, Audrey Edmonds, an exoneree from Minnesota, sentenced to 18 years in prison for the death of a seven-month-old. Benny Starks, released from prison in Illinois after 20 years for a crime he did not commit. Keith Findley is assistant professor of law at Wisconsin Law School and the president of the Innocence Network. Vanessa Potkin, a senior attorney for the Innocence Project and one of Benny Starks' lawyers. And we will continue on the State of Things in a moment. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio, recording live from Charlotte, talking about the Innocence Network Conference. With us, Audrey Edmonds, an exoneree from Minnesota, sentenced to 18 years in prison for the death of a seven-month-old baby. Benny Starks, released from a prison in Illinois after 20 years. That happened in 2006 after he was exonerated just months ago. Keith Findley is an assistant professor of law at the University of Wisconsin Law School and president of the Innocence Network. Vanessa Potkin is a senior attorney for the Innocence Project and one of the lawyers for Benny Starks. So let's talk a little bit about this network and what it's like to be together with other exonerees. Benny Starks, let me start with you. What is it like to be here with other people in your situation?
It's just like family, you know. A couple of the exonerees, we've actually been corresponding for like since 2007. So it's like, you know, if I got a problem or something's going wrong in my life, it's like I can call him, you know, like my brothers, you know.
I would guess, Audrey, I mean, this is one of those circumstances and situations which perhaps nobody else can understand except for another exoneree, right?
Very much so, yes.
Mm-hmm. What is it so, and what have you gained from being at a conference like this with other exonerees?
It's very uplifting to be able to support one another, to share their stories. And just like Benny said, nobody can really understand it. It's great that other people care, but nobody can understand it unless they've been through it. And it's just good to be able to network and to discuss problems that we've had or things that we can do to help one another out or to make progress with the system.
You can help us understand what some of those things are. We assume once you're we would hope to assume that once the evidence that proves your innocence is available, you'd be out, but clearly that doesn't happen. But once you're out, what are some of the problems you're facing? We might assume, okay, home free, finally that's over, but I guess not, huh, Audrey?
We've lost our status in the job community. When I got out, the unemployment rate was very high, so here I've got this big blank in my resume record, and on top of that, we still have a criminal record, and many companies won't hire anybody with a record, even if it's been exonerated.
Well, Keith, let me ask you, why is that?
Well, what Audrey's referring to is that once you've been exonerated, the official record may show that the charges have been dismissed, but the record is still there. And especially in this electronic era where so many of the court records are on file, employers can just pull it up on the internet and see, oh, you've been convicted of a murder. Yeah, but I didn't do it. Well, you've got a lot of applicants. You're going to take a chance on the one who was convicted, maybe wrongly, or one who never had any problems at all. We've had clients, a professional who was convicted of murder, was exonerated and then applied for a job as a janitor and was turned down, and the employers told him, well, you must have done something for them to arrest you. So it's nearly impossible to overcome the burden that imposes on a person.
And there's also a stigma to being imprisoned. We have had people who have come out and we're trying to help them find housing, and landlords say, hey, that guy might be innocent. It's horrible what happened to him, but he spent time in prison and I can't have him living here. So just the experience itself, even if there's an acknowledgement of innocence, can be hindering.
Benny, what's it been like for you since you've been out?
It's been, I have good days and I have bad days like anybody else. I got a family that supports me, and like I say, good days and bad days.
Do you find that people are still skeptical? Some people still think you must have done something?
To go back to what we were talking about earlier, I was actually exonerated, from the evidence in 1986 through ABO blood typing, which the serologist falsified and said I could not be excluded. So,
So not a positive match, but we can't exclude.
1986, it was no DNA, it was ABO blood typing. But, like I say, I have good days and bad days, like anybody else, It was a wonderful day when I got out. It was a wonderful day. But life goes on, like my case is just a short story from a long past.
20 years in prison, have you received any compensation from the state?
No, we haven't.
Ken, Vanessa, what's the process there?
Well, there's two ways that people usually are able to receive compensation. 27 states right now have laws that provide for compensation for wrongful convictions, and those are pretty much no fault. If you can prove that you're innocent and you serve time in prison, with some caveats, you can receive compensation. Some of those are good laws and some of those are grossly inadequate. Right now in Illinois, you can receive, I believe it's, a few hundred thousand dollars. So for somebody who did 20 years, that's really kind of outrageous rate of compensation. Some of the laws are better. They don't have caps or provide, the federal standard is $50,000 per year of compensation for a wrongful conviction, $100,000 if you're on death row. So we definitely need every state to enact a compensation law. If there, in addition, is some type of provable misconduct in your case, and there's all sorts of immunities for what prosecutors do, but certain types of misconduct can rise to a constitutional lawsuit, and people have received compensation that way. I think there's a misconception out there that if you, were locked up 20, 30 years for a crime you didn't commit, you're going to get millions of dollars. And unfortunately, for most people, that's just not true. In 2009, we took a look at that time there were 240 people who had been exonerated through DNA testing. And when we took a look at them, only 40% had been compensated at that point. So, many people come out and 10 years later have received not a dime.
Vanessa, have you received compensation or are you pressing for it?
No, Audrey hasn't received anything yet, and we're sure hoping that through some work that's being done on a new law in the state of Wisconsin that something will happen, because right now Wisconsin has a very tight law. It's $5,000 a year with a cap at $25,000.
That's it. That's the most you can get under Wisconsin law. And even to get that, you have to prove your actual innocence by clear and convincing evidence, which is, how do you prove a negative? It can be very, very difficult in cases like Audrey's where you've basically undermined the proof against you, but it's very hard to go the next step without the DNA.
Well, I wonder, too, in a case like yours, Audrey, where you don't have DNA evidence, so there's not this conclusive evidence you were not at the scene, but this kind of post-mortem diagnosis, do you find that it's more difficult for you to convince people? Do you have to convince people? And are people a little bit doubtful when you encounter them?
I'm sure there's always going to be some. I've gotten more and more support. I recently had a book come out titled It Happened to Audrey, and I've spoken to many people since that has come out, and I get more and more support. Otherwise, I can't convince people that just don't want to answer to that these things do happen. Some people just feel that just because you're charged, everything has been done correctly.
You know, Keith, this question of compensation we think is a matter of justice. It ought to be done. On the other hand, I can see it working against exonerees or potential exonerees. It's one more barrier. It's one more reason the state doesn't want to admit it's wrong. If we do that, it's going to cost us money.
That is a risk, and I suspect that may be behind what's prompting some prosecutors to, in the face of overwhelming evidence of guilt, to some prosecutors to push forward to try to coerce a person into accepting a guilty plea, for example, to a reduced charge with time served, so that they get their freedom, but then they can't claim innocence in a lawsuit. I have no empirical evidence to support that, but there is at least a sense that in some cases state and county officials are trying to protect themselves in that way.
Well, let's try to find out what else is behind it, why this steadfast resistance to acknowledge a mistake. I mean, it's interesting in your case, Audrey, that the parents of the child of the victim still want an apology from you. I think this suggests how emotional these trials are, all trials probably, but certainly when there's violence at stake. We like to think that this is a rational process, a forensic process. We present the evidence, and some 12 strangers will make a judgment based on a rational decision. But that doesn't happen. That's really not how it works in the courtroom, is it? And I guess, Vanessa, I'll ask you, and in the face of that, if that's true, if we have a much more sort of narrative-driven process, is this process so inherently flawed that it requires an overhaul if we ever expect justice and an end to these kinds of programs?
I think so. Part of the problem is, when you have cases where somebody's been wrongfully convicted and the prosecutor doesn't come forward and acknowledge that the person is innocent, then it leaves a lingering doubt in the community. It leaves to kind of the experience that Audrey's having. And when the prosecutor has pumped the family up so much and the family has believed for so long that this is the person who did it, or the victim believes this is the person responsible, it really takes a lot to kind of come to the realization that the person is innocent. And if you have the state, police and prosecutors holding on to the conviction, that day's never going to come. And so we really, our whole system is about taking accountability for what you do. So we need the state to take accountability when it makes mistakes or when it intentionally convicts the wrong person. And that is just, absent. We have an adversarial process, but at some point it can't be, just about getting a conviction and building up your career as a prosecutor. There has to be some commitment to truth and some commitment to, a prosecutor can't think it's just the police bring me the case and it's my job to prosecute what I'm brought. Everybody at every level has to, be constantly scrutinizing and making sure that, we're not sending innocent people to prison. And the whole system does need an overhaul. I mean, we've gone crazy in this country. We incarcerate more people than anybody else in the world. And so it's no wonder that we have the problems we do with our justice system.
Well, and we pursue the death penalty, and I think the stakes get even higher. If it's a capital case and I find out that as a prosecutor I have been advocating death for this individual and then learn that I might be wrong, isn't it even more difficult for them to stand down and say, oh, I made a mistake in this case, the man I thought you should kill?
It might be. It's hard to sort of untangle all the different psychological processes that go into this. But we do know that there are, in fact, a lot of cognitive biases that create this resistance. But if I could, I'd like to address the death penalty question in another respect as well. And that is, the death penalty sort of casts a shadow over the whole process, even when it's not imposed. The first exoneration that we had was of a guy named Christopher Ochoa, who was actually coerced into confessing to a really awful rape and murder and then pleading guilty to it because he was basically threatened that if you don't, you will be executed. And they really convinced him of that. And so it really sort of reinforced in my mind the way in which having such a draconian penalty gives the prosecution so much power. They have the virtual atomic bomb of the criminal justice system that they can coerce people, even innocent people, to accept deals that will save their lives.
In fact, prosecutors have said this is why in those states where we have the death penalty, we don't want you to change it because it's been such an effective tool in getting confessions. Because in many states, even the person who didn't pull the trigger, if they were involved in a crime that was a capital crime, they can also be given the death penalty, which gives you a wonderful witness who can say pretty much anything you want them to if you say you were there and you're also eligible for the death penalty.
Yeah, fortunately, I don't have to deal with that very much because Wisconsin doesn't have the death penalty. But it can indeed present a lot of corrupting forces.
These were not capital cases that we're talking about today, but one other factor that we've heard so often plays a part is race. To what extent do you think race taints our system? I'll start with you, Keith.
Well, we have just indisputable evidence that the system is not racially neutral. We know that simply if you look at the conviction, if you look at the fact that, for example, in drug crimes, the data show us that African Americans and white people use and sell drugs at about the same rate, yet we arrest far more African Americans for drug offenses. When we go to the next stage, far more of those people, African Americans, are convicted. And of those who are convicted, far more African Americans go to prison and for longer periods of time. So we know that. But we also see that reflected in the wrongful conviction cases. For example, if you look at rape cases, we know that most rapes happen within one's racial group. Something around 10 or 12% of rapes are cross-racial in the sense that a black man is convicted of raping a white woman. But when you look at the exonerations, it's pushing 50% are black men who are exonerated for having been convicted wrongly of raping white women. So there's absolutely a racial effect that we really haven't come to terms with yet.
Vanessa?
Absolutely. I think that what we see in terms of wrongful convictions is just a microcosm of what we see in the entire criminal justice system in terms of the racial bias that Keith just discussed.
You know, wrongful convictions is one thing, and the statistics there have to give you pause and have to make you wonder about the amount of racial bias built into our system. But I'm even looking at these two cases sitting in front of me. Audrey is a white woman was convicted of killing a child. The child did die. And when going through the case, there was an assumption that this was a homicide. He received 18-year prison sentence for what would have been killing a child. Benny, you were sent to prison for 60 years for battery and rape. Benny is a black man. What's the math there? How do we even create our criminal justice and our penal system? Because the arithmetic there doesn't work for me.
Well, you know, it has to do in part by, you know, different states have different penalties for different crimes. But our, you know, that is also has gone awry in our country. You know, we handle a lot of cases in Louisiana. And, for example, the sentence for aggravated rape in Louisiana is life with no possibility of parole. So we have many clients who are 18 years old, accused of a crime. You know, they're maintaining their innocence, but they were sent away, to Angola prison where they will die or, you know, spend the next 60 years. So we should really think about resentencing in this country. I mean, some of the sentences, you know, horrible, horrible crimes that ought to be punished and people need to be held accountable. But we have to stop and think, is it appropriate life without parole? We have to give it much more thought.
I want to thank all of you for being on the program today. Vanessa Potkin is a senior attorney with the Innocence Project. She was one of Benny Stark's attorneys. Benny Stark's released from prison in Illinois after 20 years. Audrey Edmonds is here with us as well, an exoneree from Minnesota who was sentenced to 18 years in prison for the death of a child. And Keith Finley is assistant professor of law at the University of Wisconsin Law School and the president of the Innocence Network. Thank all of you for being on the program today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And thank you for listening to The State of Things. This is the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.